From a very early age, I think I was very much aware that when people looked at me, they made certain assumptions over who I was and specifically what I could do. And I had chosen very early on not to change what I looked like from a genetic perspective and from a growth and a height perspective. But what I could do was use clothes to communicate a new vocabulary, to communicate about myself rather than always having to articulate who I was or defend those biases.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast. My guest is a writer, primary school teacher and disability campaigner. Throughout her career, Sinead Burke has worked to encourage honest conversations about disability, kindness and understanding. A lifelong lover of fashion while still in her teens, Sinead became a leading voice for diversity and accessibility in the fashion industry through her blog Mini Melange. From blogging in her bedroom to becoming one of 15 trailblazing women featured on the cover of British Vogue's iconic September issue, Sinead Burke has demonstrated that style and inclusivity can go hand in hand. She's now the CEO of Tilting the Lens, a consultancy business that asks, is this accessible, with a mission to create a more equitable and accessible world for everyone. Sinead Burke has brought that message of inclusivity and accessibility to the global stage, from speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, visiting the White House at the invitation of the Obama administration, or being the first little person to attend the Met Gala, an extravagant fashion event in the United States. Sinead Burke, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast. Tell me first of all about your parents.
My parents, they are wonderful people. And, you know, I think about the luck that I have being born into that family unit. My dad has dwarfism, much like myself. We would both describe ourselves as little people. My mother is non-disabled. I'm the eldest of five children. Of those five children, the rest of my siblings are non-disabled. And my parents are warm, nurturing people who grew up understanding the importance of education, though they didn't have the privilege or the opportunity to access education beyond secondary school themselves, and were the kinds of parents who understood that homework needed to be done every night and supervised, and we were read bedtime stories, and they created the environment, no matter where we lived. We grew up in Finglas and then moved out to Navan in County Meath, where it was not where you lived, but how you lived, which should be the guiding principle. And just the need to be part of a community, to be part of a collective, and really just taught us from a very, very young age that anything was possible. We may, each of the five of us, find different ways to achieve our goals and dreams. And they were just such brilliant mentors in the notion around kind of justice and fairness. And, you know, even to give an example of conversations that would have happened at home when my siblings were getting a bit older, it was very obvious to them and their friends that their father was a little person, that their sister was a little person. And our parents advocated alongside us from the earliest of age with language to be able to facilitate those conversations when we were no more than 3 or 4 years old. Because whilst our family looked different to the families of our friends and our schoolmates, it was our family, and families are different all over the place.
And at one stage, I think you were given the option or the opportunity to have some sort of surgery or procedure that would have stretched your legs, literally?
Yeah. So,
or your limbs?
There's been a number of different innovations and medical interventions that have existed in lots of communities around disability and rare disease. One intervention that was quite popular, at least more well known at the time when I was about 12 or 13, was called limb lengthening. And we actually see lots of people undertaking limb lengthening, both those who are disabled and non-disabled. So the option was is that the procedure would deliberately fracture your limb bones, and you would have pins in the limb bones and a cage structure around the leg. And over time, what you would do every day is kind of twist those pins so that the fracture increases so that new bone can grow. So maybe to give an opposite example, when somebody breaks an arm or a leg, what often happens is you get put in plaster cast to hold the bone firmly so that it mends together. The idea of this is that you would stretch apart the break so that new bone could grow, in turn lengthening the leg. And the time in which I had to make the decision around that, I was about 13 years old. And my parents undoubtedly had their own opinions over what I could or should do. And they left me to make the decision and said, you know, this is your body, this is your life, you need to make the choice that's right for you. And when I was 13, I was, you know, a young girl growing into my teenage years, going to become a young woman. And I think on a surface level, I could see some of the advantages of being taller in terms of physical access.
And what you are 3 foot 5 inches in old money, as it were.
Sure.
I don't know what the centimetre equivalent is. So what was the prospect that was held out to you by going through this?
I think at the time what I was being told was the maximum height that I maybe would gain is up to maybe 6 inches in height. And the reality is that probably would have made some difference to me in terms of like that, just simple things of being able to reach or being able to be slightly more independent, whether that is in the supermarket, whether that was in the classroom. And I think the other thing that was communicated to me at the time is that it may help me to feel more included in society because I would be closer to being taller. I would be closer to being non-disabled. And again, at 13, you know, I was surrounded by such positivity around my disability. I had a community of friends who looked like me. I had a collective of people who were older than me who had my disability. So I had all of these examples, both in my home and in my community, where it looked like everything could be okay. And I remember at the time realizing that, yes, it would be easier to reach light switches. But the reality is we can change those things quite easily. And I didn't want to change me.
When you were even younger than that, when you're, I think I would calculate about 8 or 9 years of age, your parents set up a charity. It's now called what, Little People of Ireland?
Yeah, so they founded it when I was about 7 years old. It was originally called the Irish Association for Restricted Growth. And I think their rationale for setting up that organisation at the time was trying to understand the mismatch in information that they had, both from the medical profession in terms of the service availability and just communication. But more specifically, my dad is a little person, but he was born and grew up in England. So his awareness of growing up having dwarfism in Ireland was completely disparate. He had no information, no expertise. So they found themselves having conversations with experts, with consultants, with doctors, with, you know, the public service, and were rehaving these conversations again and again, and just had the idea, you know, we can't be the only ones asking these questions. We can't be the only ones trying to crowdsource this information. So they set up the charity with this ambition of trying to bring families together so that there could be social support. Again, that idea that visibility and representation is really important, but also to bring research together, to bring ideas and innovations together, and to just create that sense of community. And it still exists today.
And you obviously and they are quite comfortable with the description or the term little people. Now, you know, maybe superficially, I would say, gosh, why do they go for that? I mean, you know, you associate with people like Leona Helmsley, the New York socialite who went to jail for tax evasion. She said, oh, well, you know, only the little people pay taxes. Mm-hmm. Or again, going back further, Darby O'Gill and the little people, which just got to do with leprechauns and that kind of thing. So I wondered, would people not feel a bit patronised or demeaned by such a title?
I think language is deeply personal. I also think that in terms of language, it's also always evolving, right? That idea that the organisation used to be called the Irish Association for Restricted Growth was relevant terminology at the time. Mm. As we think specifically around disability, the language is always evolving. A decision was made to follow in the language of other international organisations. So we have Little People UK, we have Little People of America, which was one of the first and still is the largest organisation. And I think, you know, there is undoubtedly friends of mine who wouldn't describe themselves as a little person, would maybe describe themselves more comfortably as having dwarfism. I think the reality is with that nature, that language is always evolving. It may change in the future, but for me, what I feel comfortable about it with is it identifies my personhood. It immediately identifies my size. But like that interchangeably, I would often say that I have dwarfism because maybe for those not connected to the community, defining myself as a little person doesn't give them as much of an insight at maybe saying that I have dwarfism does.
There are words, though, that you do find, and you mentioned this in one of your TED Talks, that you find offensive.
Yeah. Again, to that point of language evolving, you know, as we think about even the language around disability and, you know, as we look to France and to the US, often the language of handicap is still in use in French, in the French language. There is no other word for disability except handicap, which is genuinely interesting in terms of how language is or isn't evolving. I think lots of disabled people would continue to be challenged by that language. In the UK, we often hear about the language of impairment being used. Some disabled people people here in Ireland still favour and use that language, whereas other people don't. In Irish society, we often use euphemisms like special needs, differently abled, different abilities. I don't like using those languages and those terminologies because I think they defer us away from using the term disabled. In my community, most specifically, and what we see with great prevalence now with TikTok and with various other kind of channels of communications, we're seeing more words that were historically known to be unacceptable, whether that is midget. And I think it is all of our responsibility to not allow those words, which cause such harm to people, to be used with great frivolity in society and to be used quite flippantly as if they have no meaning. And I think language always has meaning and always has historical context.
With those parents and their campaigning instinct and initiatives, it was probably no surprise, or maybe it was inevitable, that you would begin campaigning yourself. And it began, didn't it, with a blog. Tell me about Mini Mélange.
So I was always very interested in fashion growing up, and I was always very interested in storytelling and communicating. I think if I was to guess, my interest in fashion probably came about due to my dad not being able to help me in that domain. It wasn't his interest, and it set me off to try to understand the industry and the system. From a very early age, I think I was very much aware that when people looked at me, they made certain assumptions over who I was and specifically what I could do. And I had chosen very early on not to change what I looked like from a genetic perspective and from a growth and a height perspective. But what I could do was use clothes to communicate a new vocabulary, to communicate about myself rather than always having to articulate who I was or defend those biases. And I think very early on, I became aware that fashion wasn't offering clothes for a very wide range of people.
How did the blog go then? Who was it pitched at and what kind of following did you get?
I think at the time, I really didn't have any sense that there would be any audience at all. I think as it grew and as it evolved and as it became not just something for my own thoughts and opinions around the fashion system, but also I began asking people if I could interview them. I interviewed Jo Ellison, who was fashion editor at the Financial Times, which, you know, probably to 17, 18 year old me was a huge coup and still would be today. She's now editor of How to Spend It. And being able to learn from people from a firsthand experience in terms of what their insights were. And it grew and it evolved and it gained attention.
I suspect at this stage you probably have a contacts book to die for people like me and other people around this organisation. But look, let's leave that aside. I suspect that like any good journalist, you'd be slow to part with it. But in any event, the Mini Mélange project or initiative, that led to a visit to the White House. How did that come about?
So I had been doing a lot of kind of advocacy in the space around design and disability. And really that came from the fundamental principle in believing that, you know, as a disabled person, I am disabled by design, right? You can look through the medical model and say, oh, I have achondroplasia, I have dwarfism. But really that experience of disability comes through due to design. So even thinking about where we are today, we're in a radio studio, I'm sitting in quite a comfortable chair, but I have a footstool, which had to help me get onto the stool. And it proves that in terms of my disability, the greatest challenge is that this chair is not designed for me. This studio is not designed for me. So doing that advocacy about how we can create greater flexibility and change in design got the attention of the Obama administration. So there were some amazing disabled people working within the Obama administration, including Rebecca Coakley, who's now leading disability programs at the Ford Foundation. And just at the end of the tenure of the Obamas, they were putting together this event called Design for All, which was quite impressive because at the end of any presidency or the end of any tenure in a role, you often don't necessarily undertake new initiatives. And I was invited to come from Ireland and to present some of the work that I had been doing in the space. And most importantly, to meet other disabled advocates and designers who were working in that too.
I gather that you don't like using the word influencer, but what other way can there be to describe you?
In terms of now or in terms of then, I think what I really was trying to do was to advocate for change. I think, you know, it's not necessarily that I dislike the term influencer. I think to be able to influence someone in a way that supports them to think differently, maybe behave differently or be more aware is a gift. And I think what I was doing at that time was advocating for change.
And have you been able to bring about change?
I think so. I think in some ways. I think the reality is the change that I'm working on now through Tilting the Lens, it will probably take a greater amount of time in order to see the impact of those changes. But, you know, whether it is getting the Nibiog, which is the Irish word for little person, into the Irish language and dictionary, and the Cúpla Focalam, I think is really important. Or if we think about, you know, the work that we're doing right now around making banking more accessible, particularly for people with intellectual disabilities and particularly for deaf communities. And, you know, I think where my advocacy was in that era of 2017, 2018, 2019, it was very much rooted in visibility and representation being those definitions of success. And while I'm proud of them, it doesn't always create systemic change or create a pipeline for the next generation or other generations of disabled talent.
Before we leave the world of fashion, you began working with Vogue magazine. Now, I believe that was a particularly special moment for you, as you'd been a lifelong fan of Vogue.
Vogue is one of those concepts that everybody in the world knows of, even if you don't read it. Like, Sean, I'm not saying that you're not a Vogue reader or a Vogue subscriber, but it is a
How could you tell?
But it is a publication that we all know of. It's an institution. And in a society where so many of our institutions are eroding, it is still one that has still quite a bit of weight and influence. So getting to meet at the time Edward Enninful, who was the editor-in-chief of British Vogue, and Anna Wintour, who leads the US and the kind of global Condé Nast and Vogue, was really powerful in thinking about engaging those leaders to have conversations around what disability and design looks like. And I think, you know, at the time, my ambition was for disability to be more heavily featured in magazines, in campaigns, in runways, in product design. And I think where part of my growth and where the evolvement of the practice has gone is it's not just thinking about representation, marketing, visibility, but it's also making those structures more accessible. So to give an example, we currently have a scholarship in Parsons School of Design in New York, where we have currently 6 disabled people enrolled in master's and degree programs to study fashion design. Because while we can have more campaigns, while we can have more disabled people on covers, and I'm very proud of the covers that I've been part of, the reality is long-term change that is sustainable and systemic requires disabled people to be in leadership roles in those rooms.
You were also, you were front page news here at home when you became the first little person to attend the Met Gala, which is an event of some prestige. Now, you say you had a very specific agenda there and it wasn't just to hang out with the Kardashians, was it?
No, so maybe to give some context, the Met Gala happens on the first Monday of May every year. The primary focus of the Met Gala is to raise money for the Costume Institute, which is the fashion department at the Met. So the Costume Institute is the only department that is not funded by the Met. So the Met funds every other department, ceramics, fine art, but doesn't fund fashion. In turn, to be able to support fashion as a vehicle for art within the museum, the fashion industry responded. It began with Diana Vreeland, who was the editor before Anna Wintour, and became this enormous fundraiser where tickets are quite costly and has in many ways grown a life of its own, with the night of the Met Gala being a showcase of stairs and fashions and who's who in terms of attending.
Costly? How much?
I think it goes upwards in terms of close to maybe $100,000 to $250,000 a ticket, depending on the table.
Wow.
And much of that is funded by brands. And that is made as a donation to the Met and the fundraising in order for those roles to exist.
Obviously a big thing to be invited. And you went there with what exactly in mind?
So I went in 2019 when the theme of the exhibition, so again, the night is around the opening of the summer exhibition within the fashion department within the Costume Institute. So I went on the theme of camp. So what I wanted to do was to try to have meaningful conversations with leaders to think about that systemic change, but specifically also around art museums and galleries. You know, as we think about museums and galleries, often they are a space not explicitly welcome to disabled people. How many of us have gone around a gallery and thought, I'd love to sit down. There's nowhere to sit. Or if somebody is blind and low vision, being able to even access or understand the materials that are on the wall. And just from a fashion museum perspective, how rare it is that there is representation of mannequins of different types of bodies. And fashion is particularly challenging in this way because there is often only one definition and one type of body. So being able to have conversations with the Met staff, so Andrew Bolton, who leads the Costume Institute, resulted in several years later the Met putting on a winter exhibition called Women Dressing Women last year, which was led by Melissa Huber, the curator. And for the first time ever, they had representation of disabled mannequins within that exhibition. So they had a mannequin of me, somebody with dwarfism. And then they had a mannequin of Aaron Rose Phillip, who is a black trans disabled model. And that was the first time that the Met as an institution had that representation. So sometimes change takes far longer than you think. And also those two mannequins are not enough in terms of representation, but it's a start.
Many years before you went to the Met, you entered a competition back home, Miss Alternative Ireland. Mm. Tell me about that.
So I had been fortunate to attend Alternative Miss Ireland in the Olympia Theatre in around 2011. And it very much aligned with my experiences. My college life, I was training as a primary school teacher and I loved it. And part of college life is going out sometimes. And I found those experiences really challenging. I found nightlife really challenging in the sense of so many of bars and clubs are not accessible for disabled people, but also just people's behaviours in those spaces and in those venues are often not kind, not considerate. And at times they were harmful and felt very unsafe. And it led me to start going to places like the George on Georgia Street, or what was the Dragon on Georgia Street, or the Front Lounge. Some of those places don't exist anymore because they were spaces dedicated for the LGBTQ community. And they felt like safe spaces to me because in so many of those rooms that I got to be in on those nights, everybody had a lived experience of difference, which meant everybody was welcomed. And I was so moved by that, that when the opportunity came up in 2012 to participate in Alternative Miss Ireland, I entered. So I retold the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, so how Alternative Miss Ireland worked. And 2012 was the last year that it ran. It was a fundraiser for HIV and AIDS charity. So those who bought tickets, that's where the money went. And on stage, on the Olympia stage, you had to put together a 7-minute performance. So as I said, I retold the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but changed the framing. So it opened with me standing on a 4-foot platform wearing a Snow White costume with a voiceover that said, "Once upon a time in a land far away lived a little girl who maybe is or maybe isn't gay. Is she alternative? Why, yes, she was born this way." And Lady Gaga's Born This Way started. I had 7 tall people taking up the roles as the 7 dwarfs coming out on stage. They ripped the skirt. They lifted me down. We did full choreography. I had my mother come out as the Wicked Queen, who gave me an apple and I died. My father came out as Prince Charming and we won. And the stage name that I used for that was Minnie Melange, which then became the name for the blog. And that night is one of the memories that I cherish most because it was just such a celebration of difference. And that difference is not something that is negative. It makes us who we are. And it was led by Panty Bliss and Dolly Grip. And it was just an amazing experience.
You talked about the fact that places like the George provided you with a safe space. Tell me about your own experience.
So I think, you know, those experiences that I had when I was in college were often quite challenging. I think, you know, being a disabled woman also, it often meant that in those spaces I felt quite sexualized and people who were trying to appear cool in front of their friends were targeting me and making me feel really awful. And I think what it was making me do at the time was making me opt out of those social occasions. Mm. And that was less the responsibility of, you know, not being able to reach the bar or not being able to reach the seating, and more just feeling so unsafe for other people's entertainment that I more and more, I think, opted out, which is probably why I developed a work ethic and, you know, didn't find solitude in those places.
And were you able to just develop ordinary personal relationships? I mean, cutting through all of that.
In terms of like friendships, or do you mean romantic?
Well, either or both, insofar as you want to talk about them.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that I have been really fortunate about, I'm not the kind of person who has had a group of friends that has stayed the same group of friends since school. I really admire the people who, you know, have friends since they were in junior infants or sixth class. My life has taken lots of different pivots and turns. You know, I've had more than one career in my 34 years. And what I have taken with me through those years is friends from different areas and sectors and different parts of the world. And I love those people deeply. I think I used to really struggle with thinking even about the concept of love as something that you have for friends. I don't know if it's being Irish or upbringing that, you know, you can only love your partner or your children or whatever it might be. But those people have made me who I am. And they are the people who keep me in check who encourage me, who nourish me. And, you know, I am a good person who cares about people. So that idea of being able to foster relationships, I feel like I have been able to be a magnet and connect to people with similar values. And, you know, I think about the earliest lesson that my mother taught me when I used to come home from school and be a bit upset because kids in the playground would be really cruel and unfair. And my mother said to me, you know, who do you want to be? Do you want to be the kid that is making fun of somebody else, making them have a bad day so that they can feel and they can have a good day? Or do you want to be the person who's just being themselves and isn't causing harm to anybody else? And, you know, that is a very simplistic tale of people and human behaviours, but it has stuck with me and made me, yeah, attract, I hope, the right kind of people.
You've described your work at that time with Vogue and the Met Gala as an era in time. Does that mean we won't see you on the front page or the cover of Vogue again anytime?
Listen, it's not my choice. I'd like to sit here, Sean, and say to you, you know, I have the power to make those things happen. I think, you know, it was a great privilege. And if I even reflect back, you know, I got to be on the cover of 2019, which was the Forces of Change issue, and then got to be on the cover in 2023, which was the Reframing Fashion issue. And for me, that transformation between that era is quite important and pivotal because, you know, between those years, British Vogue came to me and said, we really want to make our most accessible issue to date. We want to have the most amount of representation in one issue to date, but we can't do this. Can you help us? And what ended up happening was I became the consulting editor along with my colleagues, and we put that issue together. We put 5 disabled people on different covers. We had 19 disabled people featured inside through a lens of intersectionality. We had disabled writers. We made it available in Braille, and British Vogue continues to be made available in Braille every issue. We supported education and training around digital accessibility to ensure that whether it's, you know, photo shoots or imagery going up online, that it's more accessible. And I think about that pivot of being on the cover in 2019, which was enormous for me personally, and a world record in terms of no other little person had ever been on the cover of Vogue ever before. And yet acknowledging that whilst that's something to be proud of, it's also a huge responsibility to make sure that you're not the last.
And when you appeared, Sinead, on the cover of the Forces for Change issue of British Vogue, it was guest edited by the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. Did she personally invite you, or how did that come about?
Yeah, so I had a phone call with Edward Enninful, who was the editor-in-chief of British Vogue at the time. And he asked me on the call, he said, you know, we're putting together the September issue of British Vogue, and actually it's being guest edited, and in terms of this invitation, I would love for you to speak to our guest editor, Meghan. Do you want to talk to Sinead? And she was on the phone and she invited me and asked me if I'd like to be part of it. And all of a sudden I knew not just it was going to be a very historic moment in terms of the September issue is the most important issue of any issue throughout the year, but obviously with Meghan's sponsorship and amplification, it was going to reach further, shall we say.
And how did you find her to deal with?
I was really impressed with her. I've been fortunate to chair panel discussions with herself and Prince Harry afterwards. And, you know, I think there was, and there could be an ease in putting oneself on the cover of those kinds of things, but to deliberately choose 12 to 15 different people whose backgrounds are so different to yours, you know, that moment changed my life.
Have you stayed in touch?
A little bit. You know, we're not meeting for coffees in California, but a little bit.
Yes. When you say it changed your life?
That moment of visibility and that moment of sponsorship in terms of not just herself, but also the fashion industry gave access to a wider network. And I think even more empowered me to see not just the opportunities that I had, but 2019 was, you know, very close to the pandemic, in the midst of the pandemic, and coming from being on the front cover of Vogue to then coming back to Ireland for the pandemic, living with my parents. I had never moved out and couldn't afford to buy a home and couldn't afford to rent, and renting was inaccessible. So I was living with my parents, which I was very lucky to do, but I was in my 30s. I had so many moments of solitude and reflection, and it made me really kind of take a step back and question if not just the cover of Vogue, but if the advocacy that I had been doing in the fashion industry to date had really created change and made an impact for me.
Have you ever considered moving abroad? Because surely you could have a very successful career with the profile that you have and obviously your expertise and your knowledge.
I think there was times when I thought about moving to different parts of the world. You know, I think it's a very Irish story where people talk about the need to move to London or the need to move to New York. And it's definitely something that I considered. I think, speaking quite honestly, I think as a disabled person, I was aware that there were supports maybe that I needed in place in terms of just having people close. But I think at a time that could have been something I could have put in place in other parts of the world. But being very honest, I'm really proud to be Irish. I'm really proud to be in Ireland. I'm really proud to be contributing to the Irish economy. I'm really proud to be creating jobs. I'm really proud to be investing in Ireland, and there's lots that we need to change and do. But at this stage, I have the great privilege of travelling quite a bit and getting to see different parts of the world and work in different parts of the world. But my base is here, my home is here.
In addition to that, we have the European Accessibility Act coming into effect at the end of June. What difference is that going to make?
Yeah, so June 28th, the European Accessibility Act is going to come into law. And what I think is quite interesting is each EU member state is interpreting and introducing that act slightly differently. So here in Ireland, we are not mandating that the built environment has to be accessible. So unlike some of our member states, what we're going to see across Europe and across the EU is more accessible physical spaces. Ireland has 20 years to put that into law. Where we're going to see really increased accessibility is around digital services, digital communication, but also digital tools. So we will see a real increase from both government and the banking sector, but also from broadcast and television, where the European Accessibility Act is going to require a mandate baseline levels of accessibility. So you can think about that very easily, even thinking about this podcast. You know, there's going to be a need for the image that comes attached to this podcast to have alt text. And alt text is short for alternative text, which is a text-based description of the image so that people who use screen readers who are blind and low vision can access the content. Also, the availability of transcripts, knowing that not everybody can hear. So what we're going to be really seeing, I think, is a dynamic change in the availability of multi-format content. But I think something like the banking sector is going to have a real pivotal change, because as we think about even colour contrast and branding and marketing, which is going to be effective, making more events much more accessible, both digital and in person, but also thinking about how our ticketing machines work, how any app-based technologies work. And we're not just going to see this change in the EU, because what's also required is any company that is selling into the EU will have to adhere to the European Accessibility Act. So I think we're in a moment where there is such negativity around what inclusion looks like or what inclusion could be. But I really do think that with the European Accessibility Act, with this legislation and with people having to meet the requirements, we're going to see accessibility changed and enforced.
And you mentioned a few times the banking sector. Now, yeah, you've got some very specific, very easily understood examples of where the banks can literally close out disabled people.
Yeah. So one of the first projects that we did at Tilting the Lens within the banking sector was around the bank statement. And the reason I mention this is because I think there's a universality to the experience. You know, I was applying for a mortgage about a year and a half ago, and even providing bank statements and trying to have a level of financial literacy around what the bank statement is, what the acronyms look like, things that were coming into my bank or coming out with, you know, credit information that I didn't understand. But this is particularly challenging for anybody with an intellectual disability, for example. And what our research taught us, we did both quantitative and qualitative research with people with intellectual disability, is just how we are excluding people. I remember one person saying to me, I would love to get a mortgage. I would love to get a loan. But because I don't understand my bank statement, I know that there's no way that the bank would trust me to take out that level of debt because I don't feel like a valued customer. And I think it's really important that we emphasize that notion of customer, because people are paying fees. People are participating within the business of the bank. And then looking to other pieces around the European Accessibility Act, we've done research with a wide cohort of disabled people to understand their pain points in banking, and also where the law can be both something that is supportive, but also something that's deeply challenging. So thinking about, you get locked out of your mobile banking app, and just easily it can happen. If you're a deaf person, your only solution to be able to get back into the app is to ring and call the bank, which is not possible. if you're deaf. But also because of legislation around privacy, security, anti-fraud, the regulation says that somebody who's in a customer service role who is engaging with somebody and who they hear a third party or the person isn't the account holder, they immediately have to hang up. Now, this is a gap in terms of both regulation, central bank, the banking structure, but also the law in Ireland, that what they are creating is they are making disabled people more vulnerable than needs to be. And in terms of the solution, it's a potential solution in the change of the law, but it's also a solution in terms of service delivery. The main challenge is that at the moment, the only way to communicate with the banking industry is through a phone call. What about if we introduced, I don't know, customer service agents who are deaf who sign? What about if we introduced video communication where you didn't just have to engage orally, you could engage visually, which would then create a level of authentication
for that person. Are you getting anywhere with that?
Yeah, we are, slowly. I can't give you all of the details, but I think the European Accessibility Act is a real accelerator for it. We're in the midst of working with banks to review, audit, and to change those tools that exist.
Do you find them receptive to the points that you make?
I think the European Accessibility Act is a very good lever that in terms of, you know, I have some kind of personal challenges with the notion of just being compliant. But I do think for certain sectors, when compliance is required and mandated, it moves the dial. I think the challenge sometimes with compliance is we always need to see it as the floor and not the ceiling. It is not the sum of all of its parts. It does not include everyone. It does often exclude and leave people behind. So we have to keep moving the dial. But I do think that the European Accessibility Act is going to drive that change.
Your consultancy is called Tilting the Lens. What other kind of initiatives are you pursuing through that? Because you're now an employer as well as being a campaigner.
Yeah. So I set up the business 4.5 years ago. I do not have a business background. I did not think that setting up a business was something I could, should, or would do. I never thought about being an entrepreneur or, you know, particularly being a disabled person. I didn't know what that looked like. I did a business course in Judge Business School in Cambridge and came back with the belief that this was something that I should try. In terms of the work that we've done, we have a team of six. It's really evolved from the skill sets of the wider team. So we have four key pillars. We have one, built environment. So maybe to give you an example, my colleague Orla, who's based in Belfast, is working on the design of a new building that will open in 2026 in London. It is a corporate office environment for a privately owned global company. And the ambition with that building is for everybody to be able to thrive and be successful in that building, specifically disabled people. So what often happens around baseline standards and compliance in the built environment is, you'll have seen it yourself. You go into a corporate building, there's a reception desk. The reception desk is mostly one height until the very end where there is a lowered counter. On that lowered counter, the flowers are stored and the awards are stored. So it is there because it has to be based on compliance. But no consideration has been given to the customer journey, to the employee journey, nor is it an invitation for people to actually feel like they could exist in that building. So what we've really tried to design from, whether it is, you know, automatic doors, so we've done a lot of research and focus groups, we engaged with disabled and non-disabled colleagues of this building, and we were advocating for automatic doors within the building and the space. Architects were challenging us and saying, they're ugly, they're not very sustainable. Two relevant questions or challenges. But one of the things that we learned from colleagues was that more and more were hot desking in these spaces. They were carrying laptops, coffees, helmets from bikes, and that idea that accessibility benefits everybody. We do a lot of work around digital accessibility, kind of as we spoke to in terms of the banking sector and beyond. We do a lot of work around product and service design. We're currently in the midst of doing design sprints with a large global e-commerce platform to design more adaptive clothing, not merely just as a capsule collection, but really trying to integrate adaptive fixtures and fabrics into everyday products. So to give you a specific example of that, Sean, you're wearing a lovely blue and white striped shirt, but the buttons on it are quite small. And dexterity is difficult for everybody. It is more difficult if you have a disability. It is more difficult as we age. But that shirt is designed like that because it has always been designed like that. There is no reason why those buttons couldn't be false and it couldn't be either a Velcro or a magnet, why it couldn't have a larger opening at the arms or the neck. So it's thinking about how do we design our products, particularly from a garment and a fashion perspective, yes, to be explicitly accessible for disabled people, but to acknowledge that actually creating clothes that are more accessible and more adaptive benefit everybody. And then we do a huge amount of work around recruitment. So you talked about the European Accessibility Act. There is another piece of legislation that's going to be a big driver next year, which is the Corporate Social Responsibility Directive. So every company that has more than 250 employees across the EU in 2026 will have to publicly report how many disabled people they have employed. Now, particularly in Ireland, that's going to create a big change because it is only the public sector that has had to communicate the level of representation of disabled people. So what that's going to bring about is a real cultural change in an organisation where, for one of the first times, they're going to be really keen to collect and gather this information and this data. But we know that disability is apparent and non-apparent. We also know it's something that you can move in and out of. So employers just asking the question of, are you disabled, doesn't foster trust, doesn't foster psychological safety. It doesn't encourage people to share what could be very personal information.
Because disability is not always visible, is it?
No, not at all. I think, you know, I have a very apparent disability, but I look to my colleagues who have mental illness, my colleagues who have chronic illness, also looking at those who are neurodivergent. You know, there are many ways in which disabilities show up and it's not always obvious or evident. And there's, you know, two challenges with that. I walk into rooms and it's very obvious that I have a disability. And sometimes you experience bias and discrimination because of that. And then for others who have a non-apparent disability, they have to spend a lot of their time building trust and confidence before sharing those things with people. So we're going to see sectors dramatically change because they will have to be reporting on this. And I hope what we will see is a greater understanding around the need to build trust, psychological safety within that.
You mentioned about looking for a mortgage. Did you manage to get the mortgage? How's all that been going? Have you got a home of your own now?
I do. I have a home of my own, and which I'm very fortunate to have. And, you know, is only because I set up a business, is only because I have been able to build a team and build a business in terms of that economic model.
Tell me more about the team. I mean, are they all people who are disabled?
I think I'll be really honest with you. When I started the business, Sean, I was quite adamant that everybody had to be disabled because I thought that that had to be the only result and that was the way we would do it. And the majority of the team are disabled and the majority of the team have more than one disability. We have a couple of members of the team who are non-disabled. And I think that's also really important because when we think about skills, identities, lived experiences, that idea that we move in and out of disability, but it's also we're all interdependent of each other. So we're a remote team and deliberately a remote team to be able to support people's individual and collective access needs. So we travel quite a bit based on client needs or community projects that we are doing. Mm-hmm. But the headquarters, in terms of Tilting the Lens Limited, it's set up here in Ireland. Originally, when we started, we were employing people through an employer of record. Mm-hmm. So meaning that we had contracts with employees in partnership with another organization to be able to employ them locally. We stopped that last year and now employ everybody directly and have set up subsidiaries of Tilting the Lens in the UK, in Germany and in Spain.
Are you able to make money out of it?
Yeah. So one of the things that I was really, I suppose, firm on when setting up Tilting the Lens was that it was a business and not a charity. And the rationale for that was because I think in my own experience of being disabled in Ireland, disability is often a synonym for charity. And I wanted to be able to prove that doing this work around accessibility through a lens of innovation, through a lens of research, through a lens of design, was adding value to mm-hmm. companies and to organisations, and that we could be profitable and that we could be treating employees fairly. One of the things I'm really proud of is the culture at Tilting the Lens. So no matter what country you're employed in, we have the same policies and practices, whether it's about annual leave, whether it's about parental leave, whether it's about disability leave or sick leave across all of those countries. Knowing that I have a majority disabled team, we do something like where we have a well-being allowance where everybody receives €110 a month to either access counselling, a massage, childcare, and making sure that everybody has the resources that they need to be set up for success. And with that, we also make sure that we're measuring the value of the work that we are contributing, whether it is reports or audits or recruitment processes.
You wouldn't be the first person to leave the very interesting, challenging, and I'd imagine satisfying career of teaching behind to go into business. So take me back to your time as a teacher. I would imagine the parents and the pupils would have been very sorry to see you leave the classroom. But again, like classrooms, as we have known them, are not exactly and never were designed for people like you.
Yeah, I think when I started, I decided that I wanted to be a teacher when I was four. It was my first day of school. And while many students come out of the classroom or going into their first day of school crying, for me, I loved it. I really wanted to go. I wanted to learn. And I was always that curious child. And I came home from my first day of school and I told my parents I was going to be a teacher. And they said, great, good, try. Why not? And my parents had never been to college. They didn't know what that looked like. They didn't know what it would look like for me. And I was really lucky that I was born in 1990. You know, I grew up in an era where we as a country were introducing free access to third level education. My life would be very, very different without that policy. You know, I'm fortunate to have a degree, a master's, a couple of honorary doctorates, and those things are only possible because of timing. And I loved it. I loved training to be a teacher. Of course, people had questions. Trying to get teaching practice placements required a huge amount of advocacy from the staff that I and the lecturers that I had in Marino. And yeah, I think there was initial questions around how I would teach and how I would reach things like the blackboard or the whiteboard or the light switches. But for me, I had a very fundamental view that being a teacher was about being a facilitator.
And what classes did you teach? What age were the children?
So I taught junior infants and then I taught fourth class, but I spent most of my time with sixth class boys in the inner city in Dublin. And I loved it. And, you know, I think...
That was quite a thing to take on.
Yeah.
Sixth class boys, inner city Dublin.
They were amazing. They were amazing and I loved them. And I think what I tried to do in my classroom was build a culture of respect. I grew up in Finglas. I went to DESH schools, disadvantaged schools, my whole life and was fortunate to have amazing teachers. And what I always understood around what made those classrooms and what made those teachers special was they brought home into the classroom. I understood very quickly as a teacher that classrooms and schools can be very intimidating places for parents and for families, and that not every family and not every structure is the same. And part of my skill, I think, was bringing the classroom in to make what was often seen as very academic or curriculum focused topics really challenging. So to give you an example, I used to teach maths through the local takeaway menu because there was questions of literacy in my classroom. Not everybody had the same levels of literacy, but everybody could read that menu. Everybody knew that menu inside out. And even thinking about topics such as long multiplication or division seemed very abstract and not very useful to day-to-day life.
What about the kids' attitude to you? I mean, you know, you could get a sixth class boy who might be, you know, nearly 6 feet tall and they might be inclined to say, well, you know, who have we got here kind of thing.
Sure. Stature doesn't equate to respect and respect doesn't equate to stature. I designed my classrooms always so that the students sat in a U shape rather than in clusters or in groups. Mm. And from a health and safety perspective, that meant that they could see me and that I could see them from all times. But what it created was a culture of safety in the sense that we were all sat at eye level to one another. It created an opportunity for them to ask questions and for us to be equal in position and standing in the room. And in my opinion, respect is earned. You know, I didn't go in on my first days as a teacher and demand that they listen to me because I'm an adult. I had to listen to them. I had to have an understanding of who they were, what they were concerned about, and value them as people in order to be treated with respect similarly. And of course, there's tough days. I'm not going to sit here and say that teaching is easy. My God, teachers have some of the hardest jobs that exist. But I loved it. And I felt that, you know, children are so curious and interested in the world and we undermine them constantly. And they rose to the occasion and we worked together. You know, I couldn't reach light switches. They could. So they turned them on and off. But they couldn't do things that I could do. And it was that kind of space of interdependence that really worked.
Finally, Sinead Burke, what do you still want to achieve professionally and personally?
Professionally, I am mindful that we're in year 5 of Tilting the Lens. Most small businesses don't succeed beyond 5 years. We are in a very, very good position, both financially and culturally, in order to succeed and to continue to grow and scale in 5 years. But my goal is from the outset succession planning. I think the success of Tilting the Lens will not be always because I am CEO. What I have developed in terms of the skills of the team is a really good base of services and culture and a way of doing. And already within the team, I'm succession planning for somebody to take over the role of CEO, probably in the next 5 to 7.5 years.
Allowing you to do what? Back to teaching, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know, Sean. But I think it's not necessarily giving up the business. It's potentially stepping up into a chair role and a kind of chair of the board role. But the reality is the success of this work can't be about me and it can't be within me. So it has to be sustainable. It has to be systemic and it has to be effective with or without me. So making sure that those skills are being developed and that the next generation of disabled leaders can be in place is really important. Personally, I think one of the things that I'm really going to try to do is knit more. So I love to knit. I learned to knit when I was in primary school myself. I'm not very good at it. I'd love to be able to knit a few more patterns. I go for walks every morning. I'm trying to learn how to cook. I cooked Korean rice cakes this week. If you haven't had them, Sean, with gochujang paste, I would really recommend it. And yeah, I think it's trying to create those periods of not even mindfulness, but are things that are not so focused on the work. I think when your work and your personal life and your independence is so inextricably linked, it is really hard to create any distance from it. And I think forcing that distance is really important.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you. I've learned a lot and been inspired. Sinead Bourke, onwards, and thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole range of episodes with our wonderful guests who share their insights, including former Laskeon Corla Deputy Catherine Connolly, manager of the Saw Doctors and founder of the Galway Arts Festival, Ollie Jennings, plus many, many more. And remember, if you hit the follow button on your preferred platform, you'll be alerted when a new episode becomes available.